Right. Hi, everyone. Thanks for turning out, first of all, on a very snowy, horrible, dreadful, wet night with traffic at a standstill. It's really good of you to come, and welcome to everybody. This is the fifth NUJ Arnolfini Benn Lecture, which is an annual event whose aim is to open up the media conversation really to the public, and so that journalists and the public can meet and talk in real life without those glass walls that separate us all. Tonight we've got, I'm really, really excited and thrilled to be able to introduce you to Suzanne Moore, who's come a long way and even further in this terrible weather. She was writing her column for the Mail on Sunday earlier today, got that sent off, and then still made it on time to get here for this lecture. So, you know, lots of respect and thanks to Suzanne for making the effort. It's a kind thing to do, because the NUJ do this really as a kind of gesture for the community. Nobody's making any money out of this. It's really just by way of trying to get the whole issue of what's going on in the media out, and for people to be able to meet and talk and find out really what's going on and say the things that matter to them. Suzanne has been a columnist at the Mail on Sunday for 10 years. Before that, she was at Marxism Today. She was at The Independent. She's won lots of awards. She's a very seasoned journalist. And tomorrow, you can read her first column in The Guardian, as her new position as columnist. So I'm not going to really say anything more about her, except to say that Bristol NUJ are delighted and grateful that she was able to join us tonight. She's going to talk for a while, and then it'll be over to you and us to really open up the conversation and have the discussion, and that part of the evening is quite free. We've got to leave the premises at about 9:15. That is this room, and then we can reconvene at the bar. So over to Suzanne. Thank you very much.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for asking me to come here. It's really lovely to be asked to do the Benn Lecture, because in summer, I met Christina in London because I got to interview Tony Benn on stage, which was a real privilege. And, of course, one of the brilliant things about that man is he's a brilliant communicator. I just think of my oldest daughter coming back from Glastonbury a few years back, who's here now. And she said to me something like, "Oh, Mum, I saw this really great thing at Glastonbury." And I think I was trying to be hip, and I said, "Oh, was it the Chemical Brothers?" And she said, "No, it was Tony Benn." And the idea that Tony Benn can talk right across generations and to so many people is something I suppose that all journalists probably aspire to. He also said this once, it's one of my favourite quotes, and I think it's really pertinent for any journalist. I think all journalists should ask this. And he said, "If one meets a powerful person, Adolf Hitler, Joe Stalin or Bill Gates, ask them 5 questions. What power have you got? Where did you get it from? In whose interest did you exercise it? To whom are you accountable? And how can we get rid of you?" So I think it's a cliche, but it is a fundamental role of journalism to speak truth to power and to ask how we can get rid of somebody. I mean, that is part of a democratic system. On the other hand, how power works now is not so simple. I mean, if we look at something like the Irish bailout, and we find that politicians are now powerless against banks, but we seem shocked by that. I wonder now if this is a failure of reporting, that we didn't understand that situation. It seems to be terribly shocking to people. The other issue here, of course, is power without accountability, which is always levelled at journalists, and we'll probably discuss that later. But tonight I'm going to talk about what I do and about some of the changes that are going on in newspapers and what it means to move, as I appear to have done, from left-wing publications to right-wing publications. So I'm going to talk about my own history. If I was Tony Blair or American, it would be my journey, but it's not that. I also want to talk about the rise of the columnist. Again, that's what I do, and then look at some of the changes in social media and maybe the interaction between print and the internet. And I also want to look at tabloid values and try and end on a positive note, which may be difficult. So how did I go from Marxism Today to the Mail on Sunday? Well, I haven't changed my politics, but I have changed the place where I articulate those politics. Yeah, people might disagree with that, but that would be my position. On the other hand, I think there's a sort of fetishization of not changing your mind ever, of always sticking to the same principle. Sometimes, you know, we change our minds because things change, and it's called thinking. I mean, I found myself going through this process recently with the papal protest. I certainly didn't want to finance the Pope's visit, and I was asked to speak at rallies against the Pope. Although I was on the same side as people like Peter Tatchell, I actually found some of the protests very sneering towards people of faith, and I didn't want to be involved in that. And it was quite a long sort of debate that I had to have with myself about where I was with the papal protests. Anyway, I never applied to be a newspaper columnist. Obviously, it doesn't work like that. There's no job application form, and it certainly wasn't in the family business. I say that because it's very difficult now in newspapers to see how young people will start. I mostly see the sons and daughters of people already in newspapers taking those jobs. It's very nepotistic. I left school at 16. I mean, I'd always liked reading, but I came from the sort of family where reading was taken as a sign of depression. When I went home in my third year of a degree and I had a baby and I was doing my final year, one of the neighbours said to my mum, how was I? She's obviously got postnatal depression. She keeps on reading. So this is the sort of background I came from. And another saying of my mother's was, when asked how I was that she's still against everything, which I should think is probably what the average male on Sunday reader would think of what I write. But as my mother was a sort of working class Tory, I think I probably understand the position of some of my readers. Having a column, of course, is every freelancer's dream. It's a job that you make up as you go along. And it's a steady, financially it's steady in at a time when all journalists are being pushed around. People are continually being made redundant or having their fees lowered for articles. I'm well aware of the situation there. You can also boast quite phallically, yes, I've got my own column, it appears regularly and it's quite big. A column means that you get a picture byline. When I talk to journalism students, media studies students often, they always say they want to have a column. And I always say, well, what is it that you really want to talk about? And they say, well, they don't know. And I say, well, what newspapers do you read? Well, they don't. So what people are really saying often when they want a column is, I want a little picture of myself in the paper every week. And, you know, there's a little bit more work involved than just having that done. But it's a privilege. Of course it's a privilege. You are loved. I'm loved. I'm hated. I'm described as Marmite. You know, people love it or they hate it. I get the luxury of telling people what I think, and then they get to abuse me back. Whatever paper I've worked for, whether it's The Independent or The Guardian or The Mail on Sunday or The Observer, I've had very similar responses. People think these papers are entirely different, but they're not. The response is that I'm wonderful, that I'm awful, that I've cheered them up, that I've let them down. I've said exactly what they would have said had they had the column. I've made them see something in a different light. I'm the reason they buy the paper. I'm the reason they'll never buy the paper again. My editor tells me every sort of month or so, people have rung up and said, if she appears in the paper, that's it, I'm never buying it again. And I said, is that okay? And he's very good because he says, yes, of course, because we're assured that sale next week, they will buy the paper just to see if you're in there. Your page will be the first one that they turn to. You know, I've been called everything, main charges. I know nothing about ordinary people. And I'm their enemy. People who like you see you as their representative. The most common charge, I suppose, is that people writing to me could do my job better than me. And whereas people used to think everybody had a novel in them, which I don't think they do, everyone now thinks they've got a column in them, which I don't think they do. They probably have one or two columns in them. Most people have some strong opinions about something, which they could probably write pretty well. But the trick is not to write one or two columns, it's to sustain it over a long period of time. And I always think somebody like me gets paid not for the good weeks, but for the bad weeks. So what I'm describing then is a relationship with readers, and like all relationships, it suffers from fear of commitment. I offer familiarity, but then also the distress of not being the person that my readers thought that I was. I write personally, and therefore people take it personally. Since I first had a column, and my first real column was at Marxism Today, I was also editing the back half of the magazine, the culture section. And I was also the film critic of the New Statesman, which gave me the discipline of writing weekly. And I think it was clear that I was probably trying to write about more than just the film and cram in all sorts of other stuff. And so I got offered different kinds of columns. But I'm talking about 20 years ago. And then, you know, there were just probably a handful of columnists. And, of course, now newspapers are full of columnists. A friend of mine, when he found out that somebody we both worked with had become a tabloid editor, phoned up and asked him for a column. And this was a reply. This is obviously how tabloid editors speak. Well, you can fuck off out of here. We've already got more fucking columns than the Greek temple. And it's true. I mean, newspapers are made of columns now. As more and more people get their news from other sources, the role of newspaper journalism has become much more interpretive and subjective. And in an age of media saturation and its subsequent neurosis, information anxiety, we always want the columnist to be the trusted voice or the guide through all this sort of information. One of the buzzwords that I hear all the time now, not just about politics, but in journalism, is that people want trusted voices. This is one of the problems for bloggers. They're not trusted enough. People still trust something they read on a paper, print that's printed more than they do on a screen. And trust is a commodity. Trust is sold. People pay for it. Newspapers will reward people who the reader trusts. I'm aware that when I say this about trust, I may be talking about my generation. There's probably much younger people who do trust stuff that they read online as much as print, but I think we're on that cusp. One of the side effects of newspapers not being really about news is that the columnist is a kind of virtual friend, almost as if we write letters to each other. We don't write letters to each other anymore. But we have these kind of imaginary friends that we gossip about, even if we hate them. I mean, somebody like Liz Jones, who writes in the Mail on Sunday about all her disastrous relationships. You know, I know more about that woman's sex life than I know about the sex life of my closest friends. I mean, I know more than I want to know. But then on the other hand, I keep on reading it, so it's my own fault. And columns like that can be kind of breakdowns. I mean, narcissistic personality disorders on display, I would say, in her case. But I mean, I do think the personal is political. I'm a feminist, after all. But, I mean, how personal do we want to be? My experience in newspapers is that female journalists are pushed into this personal, confessional, sort of family issue type role, which is fine if you want to do it, but you must realise that that means that leaving women emoting about the mundanities of everyday life means that men get left to analyse politics and write the leaders and do the big stuff on policy. All my career, I have been asked to interview people that I just don't want to interview. I don't find most actors and musicians, I mean, I like what they do. They don't always necessarily talk about it in an interesting way. Some of them do, but lots of them don't. And you can, of course, get your head turned by the prospect of meeting big names and big celebrities. The whole rise of celebrity culture has sort of happened over the last sort of 10, 15 years. And fame and its sort of our preoccupation with fame dominates both high and low culture. So whenever I have been asked to meet famous people, I always think of the George Michael quote about what makes a star. He said, everybody always thinks a star has something extra, but what they usually have is something missing. I think that's true. But editors always say to you things like, hey, we've got Robert De Niro for you. And you think, oh, Robert De Niro. And then you have to remind yourself, well, look, read. Robert De Niro has not said anything in an interview for 30 years to anybody. Why is he suddenly going to say something to me? Is he going to make an exception? So you say, no, I don't want to do that. So editors say, oh, go on, Suzanne, you're such a people person, which means a woman. And, of course, I do like doing some interviews. I've done some fantastically interesting people, you know, Marianne Faithfull, Polanski, Baudrillard. I mean, people that interest me. And I really admire some of the killer interviewers, whether they're people like Lynn Barber or Decca Aikenhead or Ginny Duggery. I mean, I couldn't do what they do. And they say to me they couldn't do what I do because they really like having something to bounce their skills off. So I would say interviewing, writing a column, writing a feature, these are not interchangeable skills. Journalists should be able to do a bit of all of them a bit, but I mean, the idea that we can all do everything, I think is wrong. And some people are just much better at certain things, and those skills should be recognised. I think the problem for lots of people going into journalism, and I see this a lot in online stuff, is that people do think they can do everything. And because of the technology, everybody can produce something, but it doesn't necessarily make it good. The biggest motor of change in journalism, of course, at the moment is the technology. So I just want to talk a little bit about the technology, about social media and what's propelling real change. The musician and poet Gil Scott-Heron said in 1971, "The revolution will not be televised." And he was right, because it's come through another kind of screen. It's come through, it's been mailed, the revolution, texted, Googled, surfed, messaged, tweeted. We have been in the midst of a huge technological and life-changing experiment for the last 20 years that has accelerated massively in the last few. So even if you don't have a mobile phone or a computer or use Facebook, which would actually make you either an oddity or extremely poor or very old, you do live in a world that's changed. We have enormous access to information, instantaneous information all the time, instantaneous communication. But we still, I think, have very little understanding of how it affects us. The big companies that own the internet, and there are eight, really, think of us as consumers or clients, users, voyeurs, gamers. And governments think of us as voters or subjects to be controlled. The media thinks of us as readers or viewers, but in an increasingly fragmented way. But we still remain people, even if we spend more and more time staring at screens. And those screens reflect back to us who we are or who we want to be. And we input our identities. This is the interaction, if you like. Again, we're having a moral panic over screens at the moment. This is not new. Screens will steal our souls. It used to be about television. We used to watch too much TV. Now we spend too much time online. And the concern about what children do is the way that we talk about our anxieties. Children should be running about in the fresh air, but they can't because of paedophiles and cars. They shouldn't be locked in the bedroom playing dumb games because they'll become obese zombies. But then, of course, there's paedophiles online. So the real threat becomes virtual, and it's all centred around how much online activity that we're involved in. Some people here probably disagree with me. What we do online is actually far less passive than TV. I think there's nothing really more passive than watching TV. Because most online activity involves interaction, even if it's shooting people. It's still less passive than watching TV. Video games may not be your thing. They may just be shooting much. For some people, they are a complete narrative and complex world. And social media may be ridiculous to some people, but other people are using it in very creative ways. The thing with technology, the rule is with technology, it's simple. We like what works. So, mobile phones. I mean, look, we can scarcely imagine a time without mobile phones. And they have changed our pattern of communication. Okay, much of this communication is banal, but it's not evil. And our behaviour has changed because of this one piece of technology. And everything else will change with greater connectivity. As Clay Shirky says in Here Comes the Revolution, Here Comes Everybody, his book is called, revolution doesn't happen when society adopts new technologies, but when it adopts new behaviours. And I think we are adopting new behaviours online, which again produces cultural anxiety and shock reaction from governments. There's not a consensus anymore over what is public and what's private. Legislation is limp. We see kids with tinny music coming out of their earphones, walking around as though they own the place. We don't like it. But in some ways, they do own the technology in the way that the older generations don't. I understand the pessimism about data privacy and social media. If you're on Facebook and you haven't altered your settings, your phone number's there, your location. Eric Schmidt, the chief executive of Google, worries about how much information we're putting out online about ourselves. And this may be used for social profiling for advertisers. Do we want potential employees seeing pictures of ourselves on holiday in Ibiza? Because this is what the younger generation now is facing. Everything is accessible online. The other thing about social media, and I think this relates to being a columnist, is it pushes the trend for identity as performance. So we construct a persona, one of endless fun. If you look at any Facebook, people are never really having a miserable time. People are having endless fun. which is unreal. But then I don't really mind. I mean, having spent much of my actual adolescence sitting on a wall waiting for something to happen, I don't really see that a Facebook wall is so bad. And we could instead appreciate the anarchy of the web and its collaborative nature. Not all sharing is oversharing. I mean, who could have imagined even, you know, sort of 7 or 8 years ago, Wikipedia or WikiLeaks? WikiLeaks is, you know, a difficult issue. But the insane world of the blogosphere is very interesting to me as a journalist. I'm a fan of blogs, of Facebook and Twitter. I'm rather bored of people telling me that I shouldn't be talking to people that I don't know. I'm not five, and I don't live in a world of stranger danger. I mean, some people do tweet every time they have a cup of tea, but others inform you of all sorts of things. I use Twitter as my main news feed. There is nothing faster than Twitter for telling you the news. Nothing, no news story remains an exclusive on Twitter for more than 2 minutes, and it's quicker than all the major news sites. It's also a way of gauging reaction very fast and seeing response to particular news stories. So I found it very helpful over the last couple of years to watch what's going on Twitter. Social media didn't invent this sort of big brother identity as performance, as celebrity culture, but it does depend on a kind of deranged extroversion. There is a problem. We are all the stars of our own feeds. We're all the broadcasters of our own lives. We're all mega DJs in our heads. But one of the best aspects of this social media is its degree of transparency. So when you see celebrities using Twitter or Facebook, if they choose to communicate by this method, no PR is sitting there saying, please don't ask that. And increasingly, if you go to interview a politician, you have to deal with their spin doctor telling you what you can and can't ask. If you deal with a big Hollywood star, again, you're completely censored in what you can ask. But in Twitter, on Twitter or Facebook, if people choose this medium, then they have to sort of be themselves, or they're quickly torn apart. I think that's probably why politicians and big companies are very bad at social media. Because to sell products or policy requires more than bland statements. Anybody who watched the Labour leadership on via Twitter, you know, it was just thrilling to hear David Miliband say things like, events today in Milton Keynes, Colchester and Bristol. Hope you can make one of them. I mean, if you're using this medium just to relay information and no personality, it doesn't work. And I don't think I'm not talking about a generational thing at all, because somebody like John Prescott, who, guess what, is quite blunt and to the point, is excellent on Twitter. He says what he thinks. But one of the aspects of using social media is how much we invade our own privacy and how much the boundaries between the public and private blur. And the necessary debates and the personal and political implications are lagging way behind the technology. My view is that not to be part of it is to miss out. But I understand why people, you know, don't want to be involved in it. As I said, I'm also of the opinion that print journalists are not superior to bloggers. I think lots of bloggers are fantastic, but I do think that some people are trying to do too many things, and the lack of skills and resources shows. The successful online operations are American, and the things like Slate, I mean, it's important that those online papers that are readable are edited, and also, more importantly, the journalists are paid. People who write for Slate are edited and paid. They're commissioned, edited and paid. And, of course, as a writer, I want content to be paid for. Without paying for content, they won't, you know, people can't do it. And most bloggers do need editing, I'm sorry. There is no word length, there's no discipline, and it shows. They say in virtual space, nobody can hear you scream. I think the problem is nobody tells you to shut up. And you only have to look at the comment threads underneath Guardian, the comment is free under the Guardian, to see that some people sometimes just have to shut up, I think. But blogs are rather like columns, and they're very solipsistic, part of the kind of postmodern world that we live in. Everything is split into micro-narratives. I don't personally blog because I've got a column, and so I think, well, I get to say my thing. But increasingly, columnists do blog after they've written their columns. Colleagues of mine such as Peter Hitchens and Melanie Phillips cannot contain themselves within the confines of a mere national newspaper column. The sad truth is that, they have to just keep going on and on. They have to have the last word. One of the problems is that, as you all know, papers have dismissed a lot of their reporters, especially their foreign correspondents, and they're buying in their news from agencies. So it's very difficult. It's not difficult to see where columnists can come from, but it's very difficult to see where some of these specialists can come from. I read the papers, and I look at somebody like Robert Fisk, reporting the Middle East, living in the Middle East, passionate about the Middle East for, all his life, and I just think, where will the next Robert Fisk come from? Which newspaper is going to pay for somebody to live in Beirut for 30 years and to be an absolute expert? I'm well aware of the squeeze that's going on at the moment. I mean, it was happening. It's obviously been happening for a long time. When I was at The Independent in the 90s, I went to The Independent because Andrew Marr became editor, and he tempted me with his revolutionary idea, which was having no news on the front page. But at the time, I thought that was brilliant. And so I went to The Independent, and I'm saying this affectionately about people like Andy. I mean, somebody like Andy Marr, Will Hutton, these guys are great thinkers. They're terrible newspaper editors. These are not interchangeable skills. You cannot edit a newspaper and be bursting to write. It's a different thing, I think. But I do remember Andy at the time having to make the case very, very hard about why we had to have a film critic, why we had to have an arts critic. Mirror Group, in the shape of David Montgomery, who's just famous for coming into a newspaper and slash and burn and cutting it, was pressing us hard not to have any specialist critics. He was saying, why can't reporters do it? This is a very tabloid attitude. This is a very newspaper management attitude. You do not need specialists. Anybody can do it. Why do you need literary pages? Why can't one of the reporters do that? And of course, to cut down these specialisms is undoubtedly dumbing down. And I think specialist critics will go the way of the printers, if you like. If you think we don't need these experts, if you think, as many editors do, that we can get it all off Wikipedia, then fine. But what you can't Google is a sensibility, and that's what we're losing. Blogging sometimes is guilty of replicating that copy and paste approach, thinking, well, I don't really need to have seen art for the last sort of 15 years. Here I am, listen to me. And on the other hand, I think some of the blogs that work quite well are quite niche. But what's lacking from online and print is proper cultural critical analysis, people who really know their stuff. If we don't have that, what we're basically producing is PR. And, of course, the new kind of papers that are free on the tube, like the Metro in London, is largely sort of press releases turned into articles. Now, I just want to talk about, having flagged off the tabloid values, why I went to The Independent, why I left The Independent to work for The Mail on Sunday, and what it's like working for a tabloid. Of course, everybody thinks it's easier. A tabloid format means that you have to punch it out. When I left The Independent, I was writing two long pieces a week, two op-eds of 1,500 words. And then I got my own page, but my lead piece is only 700 words. So I went from a liberal paper to the belly of the beast. I mean, actually, The Mail is very similar to The Guardian in that both papers are fascinated by each other. Both papers know exactly who their readers are, and they just reflect their readers back to themselves. I mean, you all know what a Guardian reader is. You all think you know what a Daily Mail reader is. This is a problem with a paper like The Independent. You don't know what an independent reader is. It's a problem with The Observer now. Is The Observer The Guardian on Sunday? Once the paper doesn't know what its reader, who its readers are, they're starting to wobble. The boast that Sun journalists always make is that they could edit The Guardian, but The Guardian couldn't edit The Sun. I think actually it's probably true. The broadsheet tabloid snobbishness is not something that I really subscribe to. Increasingly, I see the tabloids do a story, and The Guardian sneers at it and then picks it up 2 days later. So, I mean, it's like when I was at The Independent, we didn't do royal stories, and then Princess Diana died. Well, we're not going to cover it. Of course we were going to cover it. I also see The Guardian, recently they published an interview with Lily Allen, just on the day when she'd had a horrible late miscarriage. If any other paper did that, they would be absolutely crucified. But the Guardian did it. So I went from the Independent to the Mail on Sunday. Is this, you know, was this simply selling out? And the classic move from left to right that everybody has said to make as they age, you know, the idea that a Conservative is just a Liberal mugged by reality. No, it wasn't for me. I won't pretend money wasn't part of it. Associated newspapers pay more than any other newspaper. And money does matter, not just because money matters, but simply that women in journalism don't often get the big jobs. It's a very male world, and the money is a signifier of that. You might not like that, but that is how the game works. Newspapers are a commodity, but they're not exactly like any other commodity because they have to be made every day. Every day they have to be different. Every day they have to be the same. And columnists are part of that brand. And like footballers, we get bought and sold. So for the Mail to have somebody like me there, it allows them to... they think they've got this lefty feminist. It allows them to believe that they are pluralistic and more liberal than they really are. Of course it does. For me, it means that I'm no longer preaching to the converted. Certainly when I was writing for The Guardian and The Independent, I sometimes felt that I was just engaged in the, you know, on the left, the narcissism of small differences, a very internal political debate. So that's this kind of Faust impact. I'm lucky because I've got a clause in my contract that means that I can say what I want. They have to let me know if they're going to alter it. And the big reason, of course, I went is I went from a paper with less than 200,000 readers to one with 3 million. So if you want to, you know, if you want to talk to people, there are a lot of people to talk to, and these are the readers that matter. These are the readers that, these are the people who decide elections. They're the floating voters. They're not the people who live inside the Guardian bubble. These are the people who voted Labour, Blair, and have now gone back to the Tories. Whether you like it or not, 40% of people who buy the Mail vote Labour. They're the highest female readership of any paper. And we just can't ignore, I feel we can't ignore that. But the longer I've been there and the more that I talk to people, to people who buy the paper, the more I don't even believe that there's such a thing as Middle England. I think Middle England is an imagined community, one that is manufactured. I find on most social issues, people are liberal. On immigration, they're not liberal. On fiscal policy, they're not liberal. So it's no surprise to me that a socially liberal Tory party would win and, you know, would be in power. This is sort of the vibe that you get from the readers. But right now, everybody in journalism is watching the Times paywall because we don't really have a model of a financial model of how newspapers are going to function. I go to lots of talks by experts, and it's clear that nobody really knows what's going to happen. A paper like The Guardian now has the second biggest English readership in the world, but it does not produce a penny. The idea is that at some point The Guardian will be able to cash in its online operation. Well, how? Through advertising? No, there's not enough advertising. Through subscription? The minute Murdoch put up the paywall at the Times, everybody was watching. I think this probably will be the model. But it's very, very hard to persuade people who've had something for free to pay for it. And that's still the leap. Everybody imagines that Alan Rusbridge, the editor of The Guardian, has some sort of huge master plan that he's not revealing. I'm not so sure. Having said that, I'm going to write a column for The Guardian. So I do hope that the paper doesn't, you know, completely fall apart in the next year. Currently, The Guardian are losing, you know, 100 grand a day, so it's not exactly good. And I'm going to carry on writing at The Guardian, at The Mail, and then write a column for The Guardian. So, if I can. They announced it today, and already I've had, I just thought I'd write down some things some people have said to me in emails today or on Twitter. Because it, you know, people are so fixed about what The Guardian is, what The Mail is, and there was a sort of sense, oh, she's come back to The Guardian. Oh, the prodigal sort of son-daughter returns. And somebody said to me, are you bisexual journalistically? How are you going to do this, like with The Mail of The Guardian? Someone else wrote, I thought she'd sold her soul to The Mail, but luckily it was just pawned. So it's a very, very odd thing. And Nick Cohen sent me a note saying we can drink elderflower wine in the canteen, which was a bit odd. So I'm going to try to carry on writing politically and personally, and try to change the discourse, because I think that's a lot of what I do. I'll take a news story and say, well, look at it that way. And often I'm just sort of making something seem like common sense. 2 weeks ago when the first students protested, and of course the mail was full of pictures of, you know, these hardened anarchists, I just pointed out that these people were in fact our kids, you know, and they were children. They were not hardcore anarchists. And sometimes that's just enough, just to point out, things that are going on. For The Guardian, I will hopefully